My name is Michelle Melton. I'm an associate fellow with the Energy and National Security Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. I'm here today with Stefan Auer, the Acting Managing Director for Global and Multilateral Issues at the European External Action Service, which is the EU's diplomatic service, Manish Bapna, the Executive Vice President and Managing Director of the World Resources Institute, Lisa Friedman, the Deputy Editor of Climate Wire, and Sarah Ladislaw, Senior Fellow and Director of the Energy and National Security Program here at CSIS. Today we're going to be talking about expectations for the upcoming international climate negotiations in Paris, starting November 30th and going through December 11th. There's been a lot of anticipation about the potential for Paris to be a game changer or a turning point in the context of the last 20 years of the international climate negotiations. Do you think that Paris will be a turning point in resolving a lot of the issues that have dogged the negotiations up to this point?
I think so, because we have now managed to establish the political awareness with all the political leaders. We've had a nice build-up of successful conferences and international events where this political awareness has been raised with the political leaders. And now the challenge is now to translate that into concrete action at the negotiation table so that we will that the Paris Agreement will be finally concluded in Paris end of this month.
I would very much agree with that. And I would say if we look at Paris, we should think about that in Paris in three ways. One is what countries are coming to Paris with in terms of commitments they're making around climate, what in the negotiations language are called intended nationally determined contributions, INDCs, but in plain English are offers that the countries are coming to the table with. And in that bucket, we actually have seen a real profound shift from 5 years ago. We now have 150 countries, over 150 countries, that have put offers on the table. And this actually represents a sea change from where we were 10 years ago, 15 years ago, when it was seen largely as a developed world problem. The second bucket we can look at Paris and think about is in the context of the international agreement itself. And this is what the main focus of the negotiations will be on. When you add up these national offers, you take a strong step towards getting to a two-degree pathway. But in order to really get to that pathway, we will need to see a strong agreement emerge from Paris. And finally, it's not just what governments do. It's also what the private sector does, what civil society does, what cities or subnational entities do. So there's a third piece of Paris, which are about partnerships and commitments that non-state and state actors can take together, what's called the Lima-Paris Action Agenda. And I think we're seeing quite a bit of momentum in that space that gives us a lot of confidence that Paris will be quite a success.
From a reporter's perspective, I'm a journalist. I'm always more cynical than they are going to be. But even so, I mean, I think that if you're asking me if Paris is a game changer in some ways, yes. I mean, I've been covering this since, you know, people who cover this think in terms of cities and not years. I've been covering this since Poznan, just before Copenhagen. And the attitude, I mean, this is definitely a game changer in terms of the negotiations. The attitude that I hear from everyone is so different than it was before Copenhagen. I haven't, you know, in New York and over the past couple months in Bonn, I've talked to negotiators from India, from Malaysia, from Brazil, from dozens of countries. And I haven't talked to anyone who doesn't think this is going to happen. Despite all the many, many issues that are still, you know, on the table, what stands out to me is that I haven't talked to anyone who doesn't think that there is, at the end of the day, going to be an agreement. And I think that's a real change from before. I think the lingering question is, will this be a game changer for the climate? And I think that's still a really open question.
Yeah, just to add, I'm not a reporter, but I am somewhat cynical. So I think that when you ask the question, Michelle, about a turning point, it is quite interesting. For people who aren't sort of well-steeped in the negotiations, it's hard for them to tell what success would look like or what some of those details actually mean in sort of layman's terms. But what you're doing is turning a very large ship. So turning points don't look like you're turning on a dime. They look like large, gradual bends of a curve. And if you do take that Poznan or Copenhagen to today perspective, I think Manish and Lisa are exactly right, which is it's almost the activity outside the negotiations that is sort of a representation of the kind of change you've seen over that period of time. And that change is almost easier to see than any change that happened at one of the negotiating increments. And so using that longer term frame is oftentimes easier to gauge progress as opposed to the deliverable from any one meeting.
I would just underscore, I think if the question for Paris is not, will it get us to 2 degrees? It won't. That isn't the right question, in my view. The question is whether or not Paris is a very important moment in helping shift governments and the private sector towards making investments that get us much closer to a two-degree world. And do we have confidence that the signal, the market signal, that the agreement helps create provides the right set of incentives for investments to flow into low-carbon climate-resilient areas? That, to me, is a much more relevant question. And it's also just worth noting that this past year, when one looks at energy-related CO2 emissions, quite interesting that we had modest global growth, yet emissions were more or less flat. So even already, to the point about this isn't, we need to look at Paris for what it is and not overestimate its importance. It's an important catalytic moment. But the broader decarbonization that we're talking about is something that has been going on for the past 10 or 15 years and something that'll need to continue for the next 40 or 50 years. And we just need to see greater ambition over time. And I think Paris is helping us move in that direction.
Do you think that it is enough, a strong enough of a signal? I mean, you said that you wanted to send a strong signal. Do you think the signal is strong enough?
When you look at where this conversation was and where investments were going 5 to 7 years ago, it is quite remarkable how much progress we have made when one thinks about this is a process that engages all countries in forming a solution to a problem that will require profound transformation of key economic systems, of how we produce and use energy, how we build and live in cities, how we grow our food, how we protect our forests. Let's not underestimate the scale of the transformation we're talking about. And in that context, Paris is a pretty significant moment.
And let's not underestimate that it is possible to do it. And the EU has showed that it is possible. We have, since 1990, have had a economic growth of 40%. At the same time, we decreased our emissions by 20%. So this decoupling is possible.
Thank you. All of those answers were really illuminating. It sounds like what all of you are saying is that success is not even necessarily dependent on what actually happens at Paris, but we've already achieved a measure of success. But I'd like to focus a little bit on what actually happens at Paris and what kind of markers or benchmarks there would be for success in Paris beyond just turning the big ship, having everyone on the same page, or this feel-good ramp up that you've all described?
I think it depends on who you're talking to, right? I mean, for the U.S., you can tell that success means having an agreement where all countries, at least all major emitters, are on board, as they are. They've put in commitments on the table, a deal that treats everybody equally, that manages to avoid the stickiness of having to have an agreement come before Congress, and doesn't hold developed countries to certain amounts of money and ramps up over the years and is transparent and has. For developing countries, success looks a lot different. For developing countries, you know, many of them very much want a legally binding agreement, a treaty, very much want a sense of surety about how much money, where, when it's coming. And then there's also a group of countries for whom success means perpetually keeping in place the divisions that were created 20 years ago between developed and developing nations. So I say it depends who you're talking to about what success means.
I would say the most important thing is to look at it from a global perspective. We shouldn't look at it, if I may say so, from the perspective of a certain country or group of countries. Let's look at the climate. It is global. So we have to see to it what can we do to limit global warming to 2 degrees. Perhaps the INDCs, as Manish has rightfully pointed out to, will not reach this 2 degrees Celsius objective. But we are on the right trajectory, and that is the most important thing. We will have some agreement which will translate these INDCs into concrete commitments, which will have a long-term goal to decarbonize world economy by the end of the century. This is very important. The second very important element in the agreement would need to be to introduce some sort of dynamism and progression, because we will perhaps not reach the 2 degrees objective with the commitments we will undertake in Paris, but we need to have some sort of a mechanism which enables us to reach it at a later stage. Then thirdly, I think also the element of accountability is important, so that we see whether we are on the right track. And if we are not, how we can try to bring us back on the right track, not to name and shame. No, it's not the question. It's just to help perhaps others or ourselves to go back on the track. And finally, I think what is important is that we need some sort of differentiation, which takes into consideration what countries can contribute to the limitation of global warming, but also future developments and evolvements. So this is something which I would say these are the 4 elements which I would define, if they are included in the Paris Agreement, and I'm quite confident that they will be included, that we can really speak of a success in Paris.
Thank you. Everyone has said to greater or lesser degrees that Paris is a necessary but not sufficient condition for a 2-degree world and getting us on the trajectory that we need to be on. I'd like to pick up on this concept that you introduced of progression. Manish and Sarah, maybe you guys could address, what does progression look like beyond Paris? How can that provide the surety that Lisa said that a lot of countries are looking for now in the here and now? They perhaps feel like they shouldn't have to or can't wait for this large ship to turn itself around. What do you say to that?
So when you look at the INDCs and you add them up, as Stefan mentioned, you take one fairly large step towards a 2-degree pathway, but there's 2 or 3 steps still yet to take. So the architecture of the agreement matters a lot. We need an agreement, and I think Stefan was exactly right with those 4 elements, about you need an agreement that will create both a long-term signal to the market that decarbonization is inevitable, and you need a ratchet mechanism that creates short-term signals of increasing ambition over time. So to get this question that you posed about progression, what people in the negotiations are talking about are something called cycles of improvement, basically something that may happen every 5 years, where countries come back together collectively to assess where we are towards meeting the 2-degree trajectory, and what additional commitments they plan to make for the next 5 years to help us move towards that goal.
Yeah, I think that's a great description. And one of the best success metrics for Paris that was told to me by a negotiator was that the negotiators will be out of a job. And I like that because it's said that the negotiations themselves would be replaced by something, and they'd be replaced by this robust framework that was able to sort of adapt and take on new learnings and new information. And I think that that's really important. If there would be a really important development for the international community to feel like it had a framework through which it could adopt more and additional information, right? So as today's developing economies become tomorrow's developed economies, as we learn more about how hard it will be to take or how easy it will be to take the second and third step in deep decarbonization, that there's a forum and a mechanism for being able to carry that out. As the balance between adaptation and mitigation shifts over time, right? As the politics of all of this shifts, that there are people who have confidence in the system that's been put together to negotiate and work through these sorts of systems. I think that it doesn't necessarily mean that the world won't be asking a question about whether we'll actually achieve 2 degrees over the next 10 years. I think we definitely will be. The question will be more like, what will we be doing together in this system that we've created to address those issues to try and get at that? And I think that it's not a signed, sealed, and delivered pathway towards greater ambition or progression of expectations, but it's certainly sort of the best solution the international community has been able to find so far.
I mean, I'm curious if you think that, well, just to your point, curious if people who have been giving a lot of thought to this, as you have, you know, think that this 5-year review and ratcheting is enough to bridge the gap between those tons of emissions that we're getting to with the INDCs and what needs to be done. Because we're still going to have India, China peaking and cutting emissions or emissions intensity, but still rising. So
the numbers are challenging, but still plausible, right? So if you look at what you add up the INDCs to in 2030, you get maybe a third of the way there of what certain analyses would say you need to be on a 2-degree trajectory. So you're absolutely right that we're still far from where we need to be. The cycles of improvement, I think, create an opportunity for countries to come back together and make more ambitious commitments. And I think what we've seen here with Paris is that that collective action challenge does encourage countries to be more ambitious often than they otherwise would be. You take China, for example. 5 or 7 years ago, for those of us who have been working on China, had difficulty to even talk about climate change. It had to be always couched as energy or energy efficiency improvements. Now you have actually the country not only talking about peaking emissions at or before the year 2030, but increasingly a recognition that the peak could take place quite a bit earlier. And I think the reason for that is the economic case for taking strong climate action is becoming more visible, is becoming more real. For much of the past 20 years, people saw climate action and growth as trade-offs. You had to choose one or the other. But increasingly, I think we're seeing a number of actions, whether it's around the energy system, whether it's around how cities are designed, whether it's around land use, agriculture, forestry, that activities that are good for growth can also be very good for climate. So we're beginning to see a fairly profound shift. It's not going to pivot in Paris, but Paris is an important moment in that transition.
I couldn't agree more. I think this is very, very important to have a review of our commitments in a regular sequence, because some of the member states of the United Nations are perhaps a bit reluctant at the moment to submit ambitious INDCs. And why is that? Because it's for the first time they're doing it. And they're perhaps a bit concerned that they may not live up to the commitments they're internationally pledging. So what we need to do is to show them and to help them to fulfill these commitments, that they will see that it's possible to do that. And they will see also that the technological progress and what Manish has said, the progress we have been witnessing, there's no contradiction between economic growth and the protection of the climate, can lead to a win-win situation where you invest in areas which create jobs, which create technological progress, and at the end of the day, which always also contributes to the protection of the climate, so that they will then, when they will come back to the negotiating table, they will then be able to agree to more ambitious commitments.
So we've been talking a lot about policymakers, and I want to bring it back just to the general public. A recent Pew survey that came out last week of 40 countries showed that the majority of the public is concerned about climate change. I'm interested in your perspective on what role public opinion can and has played in building momentum for Paris and in the negotiations in general, and how it possibly impacts what's happening at the negotiations. What role can the public play, if at all?
Let's take the U.S. I mean, I think buildings, I mean, from the big protest march in New York last year, that was how many? 400,000 people? To the Pope's visit and all the activism around Keystone. I mean, I think all of those measures helped build an enormous base of support for acting on climate domestically, which I think helped strengthen, say, the administration's hand as they've been pushing their domestic policies. I don't know that I have a great sense if that translates well to other countries, but the sense I get from covering this and talking to activists in other countries is that they actually are looking to the U.S. They've told me, you know, we find it hard to be activists in India and other places until the U.S. is moving, because our leaders turn around and say, well, why should we do anything if the U.S. isn't? Are things different there now because the U.S. is moving? I'm not sure I have a read on that.
I think the role of the public and public opinion is absolutely crucial to the ambition that governments can take on this issue. So perhaps there's the international climate negotiations, which are a bit more removed, but then there's the very real national level policies that countries put in place. And you think, whether it's in the United States or in India, the space that political leaders have to be ambitious is largely defined by the domestic kind of public opinion on that. And I think what we're seeing in the United States is, with the increasing recognition and awareness of this issue, that increasingly this may not be as politically a polarizing issue as it has been in the past. How this issue plays out in the campaigns and in the general election will be quite interesting. And I think that, you know, one of the questions that the Republicans will have to ask themselves at the moment, they've been quite quite adamant about perhaps recognizing that climate is happening, but unclear about the cause or what the United States should do in response. But increasingly, I think that might be a little bit out of step with even the Republican kind of electorate. And that'll be an interesting question as we move forward.
I agree. I think that one of the interesting things to watch over a period of time is how public opinion has stayed relatively even on climate change overall when you ask the public about the term, right? But when you ask the public about the impacts of climate change, you get a whole different sense of how concerned they are, right? So if you're asking about drought or you're asking about sea level rise, you're asking about other sort of conditions that come from an affected climate, people are concerned about those things. And I think one of the things that some politicians and advocacy groups have done a really good job is to make climate change a fairly ubiquitous issue, right? I mean, there isn't a lot of places you can go in the economy or society where there isn't an angle on climate change one way or the other. So it has been effectively integrated into a lot of people's mindset. That being said, I do think that to the extent that policymakers look to the public for signals about what to do on climate change, it's very, very complicated, right? I mean, I think there are some folks that have, you see this in some of the polling about how, what people think should be done about climate change in some countries. There's very technology optimistic perspectives, and others, they, you know, believe that it's a question the private sector or policymakers should answer. They would really just like it not to be terribly disruptive. And so when you translate some of the things actually being negotiated or discussed in the climate negotiations to a more sort of public audience, some of them can be quite terrifying. So I was relaying to somebody, they were asking some of the differences between the INDCs and this idea that was in the papal encyclical and is in some of the INDCs about, you know, anti-consumerism and a whole bunch of other very sort of socially motivating types of discussion threads, that's something that, you know, Americans tend to have a little bit, not all, but, you know, in general have a little bit of umbrage with. And so I think that there is a limit to public support, but it isn't necessarily in sort of enabling politicians and companies to do more. It's just in sort of deciding some of the details of it. And I think that'll be increasingly important as we're seeing more and more creativity about the policies and activities of the private sector and actually tackling the decarbonization bit of this challenge. Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting to see how different strategies or tactics encounter public acceptance, and we're actually experimenting on all of that right now. And so it's been interesting to see how the public responds to some of that.
And I think when it comes to activism, I mean, certainly in Paris, there's going to be big protests, big colorful, you know, protests. That is not going. I mean, it might be aimed at the negotiations, but it is not going to have a substantive impact on what a deal that comes out of Paris looks like. That's half-baked, and that's going to be decided by a bunch of lawyers and negotiators. But I think it does help drive the discussion of what happens next and how seriously, like you're saying, do we take all these commitments after Paris?
As you said, Lisa, you know, a lot of what's going to happen in Paris is half-baked or almost fully baked already. There's a lot of brackets. I'm wondering, and this is a question for all of you, is there anything that could happen in Paris that would surprise you?
I'd be surprised if it ended early.
Oh, my God.
One of the other metrics for success that people had described to me was how long the agreement is and how much detail you get determines how much post-discussion needs to take place. If there was a lot of T's crossed and I's dotted and we felt like this whole thing was cinched up, I think that would be surprising. I think that's, for me, you know, one of the things not to get your hopes up on. I think there's going to be a lot of discussion. It's going to take a couple years to, maybe not a couple years, it's going to take a while to sort of work out some of the details. So I'd be surprised if that happened. I'm worried that negotiators would be surprised if it's not a heck of a lot more contentious than maybe they expected it to be. I do think that this focus on getting as much detail into the apparatus that holds this whole thing together, this, you know, durable framework, has distracted people away from maybe some of the voices that are deeply discontent with the idea that this is a good enough agreement. And so I do worry that that's not something that people have paid as much attention to as they should have, but others might have different opinions.
I completely second your call for surprise if this ends not just early. I will be surprised if it ends on time, right? But I would also be surprised if there was not some element of high drama. I mean, I think everyone should be prepared. I think we saw in Bonn a couple weeks ago that, you know, there was a lot of concern about an early text that came out, right? And it really galvanized developing countries to come together. And, you know, and you had some people saying that this was a very legitimate concern for developing countries, other people saying that this was kind of a pretext to gin up some drama and get more things in, whatever it is or was. I think that we're going to see more of that. I think that we're going to see some high drama, and I would be surprised if we don't have like at least a threat of a walkout in the first week.
If I may, I just want to pay tribute in this context also to the excellent climate diplomacy of the French presidency in all this, because they have been very good in preparing this COP21. We've had the pre-COP ministerial just a couple of days ago. So they wanted to avoid what happened in Copenhagen, that suddenly, you know, the world leaders come together and they see the enormous amount of technical questions they would have to resolve, which of course just puts too much stress on them, and they couldn't just possibly try to reach an agreement there. So they have now exposed the ministerial level, at least, to these questions, and they know exactly what is expecting them. And then this is the first issue. And the second issue is, of course, that they start, contrary to what in Copenhagen happened, they start now with the ministerial high-level session in the beginning, which is very important because they will then come together and give some political guidance to their negotiators, so that at the end of the day, they will then be able, under these political strategic guidance, to come up with an agreement. I'm very confident. And why? Because again, coming back to your initial question about public opinion, the public opinion, and I'm very much encouraged by the Pew study, says exactly we have already now an impact of the climate change. We need to take actions, perhaps varying according to the countries. But then at the end of the day, everybody, global public opinion is we need something. And the expectation is there. And if you look into the impact of climate change on the security and stability of countries, this also puts additional pressure. And the migration crisis we are facing at the moment in Europe is just a tiny fraction of what may expect us if climate-induced migration is really going to take place. Then we really have a problem, and everybody's aware of that. So we need to act, and the politicians are aware of that. So I'm quite confident when it comes to an agreement in Paris.
The fact that we're struggling to think of a medium probability surprise suggests that it's been relatively well coordinated. And although there's some very thorny issues yet to resolve, I don't think there's any real significant wild cards on the table. Perhaps the most important, for me, moment took place when Obama and Xi made their announcement about a year ago that really brought the two most important players in this process together on the same page. And I think that helped create, I think, a certain foundation for this to come together in an important way.
So we've talked a lot about what the expectations are in Paris, and we've talked a lot about what success looks like both before Paris and in Paris. I'd like to talk a little bit more about post-Paris. What indicators will you look for post-Paris to say, yes, that was a success, or that didn't achieve everything that we thought it could or should have?
Well, at the end of the day, as I said, you know, the four elements I mentioned, but it's also a question on how you look at it, whether the glass is half empty or half full. And I think the most important thing is you cannot expect miracles in Paris. What you need to do is to put the whole train on the right track, that it reaches the 2-degree station. That is an important thing, and I think we will manage to do that. And in that respect, the glass is half full.
Paris is an important catalyst for creating greater ambition, but much of what the world is doing to tackle climate is actually taking place today everywhere. And I think to some extent, to me, it will be how aggressive countries are in implementing the commitments they make to Paris, what's contained in the INDCs. And I think in that respect, the nature of the agreement is one important thing to look at, but as important will be how governments move forward. The fact that we now have 40 different countries experimenting with some form of carbon pricing is quite encouraging. The fact that we have hundreds of cities, mayors, that are willing to make commitments about how they want to take action that is more aggressive than their national governments is encouraging. The fact that we have thousands of companies that are advocating for a strong deal in Paris that are starting to put in place carbon prices, even if the country doesn't have one, to help inform the decisions that they take is incredibly encouraging. And so what we need to create is to see more of that action taking place in how we actually organize our economy.
I guess I'd just say from a press perspective, I mean, there's going to be 3,000 journalists in Paris, and the vast majority of them will have never covered a COP or many of these issues before. Many of them are just starting to learn now about, you know, what is this INDC thing of which you speak, much less ratcheting mechanisms and five-year review. The single biggest question that they're going to be asking on December 11th or 12th or 13th or whenever this ends is, did you get to 2 degrees? And if not, is this agreement going to materially, substantively help keep us on a path to safe global levels, global temperature levels? I think that, you know, one of the things that folks like Manish and Stefan need to be doing is, you know, I mean, you're talking within your own circles. I think if, you know, if the big environmental groups who really focus on this stuff come out at the end of the day and say this is not enough, that is the message that you will hear out of Paris. If they believe that there's been a strong enough series of architectural elements to put the world on a path to 2 degrees, then that's the story that will come out. And then, you know, the keys after that will be how are countries making good on those promises and targets.
I totally agree. I think in some ways, I'm more concerned about post-Paris than I am Paris itself, because we've been able to take these agreements and create incremental success along the way, right? And that's been the history of the negotiations, even though progress doesn't look nearly as fast as anybody who was started this ride, you know, expected it to be. But I do think right now we're sort of in the midst of what I've been terming sort of the pre-Paris crescendo, right? It's a masterfully built sort of exercise with huge amounts of activity all designed to build momentum to a moment. And to me, the risk is that you find a post-Paris cliff where all of a sudden it looks like there is a dearth of activity and 2 degrees wasn't magically created and therefore we have failed in some way. When reality is that the progress being made towards reducing emissions has been happening sort of step by step along the way over a period of time, and nothing looked like a crescendo, right? And so avoiding that cliff, avoiding that feeling like nothing further is happening, because I do feel like we're reaching a time where even more ambition is required to be able to meet those targets. I think there'll be a lot of focus on making sure that the day after Paris looks like there's as many people dedicated to the mission as there were the day before. And I think that's going to be the measure of success afterwards.
Great. Well, we'll be watching for what happens in Paris. Manish, Lisa, Sarah, Stefan, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.